Rise to Rebellion, Disc 3.
Chapter 5. Adams. Braintree, August 1770. Near the end of May, she had given birth to a boy, and they named him Charles. He was healthy and round, with an unmistakable resemblance to his father, and if the scars were still raw from the death of their baby daughter, the new baby's bright smile and the soft, happy squeals finally allowed both parents to let the awful memories, the quiet fears, fade away. As the law practice had grown, and Adams found the days suddenly too short of hours for the work he had contracted, he yearned for the proper excuse, the legitimate cause to leave his office in Boston and return to the quiet of the family home in Braintree. As the birth had drawn closer, so too had the planting season. It was simply common sense that Abigail would return to the more peaceful place, closer to her own family, away from the turmoil that still infected Boston. He had finally persuaded himself to go with her, fighting with himself over his responsibility to the law, the practice, and his responsibility to her and the farm. As the time came for the carriage to be loaded, for the very pregnant wife and the two small children to gather together for the sad goodbye, it had taken only one look from her, one silent request, and the argument had dissolved. He had driven the carriage himself. He had gone back to Boston several times, digging hard into the papers, the hearings before the magistrates, even attending some of the town meetings, something he had rarely done before. The mood of the town had improved a great deal since the soldiers had been moved away, and though one regiment still occupied the island far out in the harbor, Castle William was not Boston. Even the great violent energy that pushed for a quick trial of Preston and his soldiers had grown calm. The radical voices that inspired the mobs were reserved, patient, and Adams was grateful for that. The most influential men in the town, his cousin Sam, his friend Joseph Warren, were content to allow events to play out, and did not see the outcome of the trial as any kind of threat to their cause. But there were still others, friends and family of the men who had died in front of the custom house, whose patience was tested by the delays. Adams would not be influenced by the discreet comments, the subtle glances he caught as he passed by them in the street. He knew that justice still meant different things to different people. As the months passed, even the strident voices from the newspapers had begun to moderate, and the passion to put Preston's neck in a noose had become subdued. It was a relief to Adams that with the trial now scheduled for October, he had time to work with Josiah Quincy to prepare a case based on law and reason. And it meant he could spend time with his family and enjoy the wonderful peace of the farm. It had been a mild summer, the farm prospering, the fields lush and green. He had left the house early, still felt a chill in the air, carried by a burst of energy that took him to the far end of the farm. He had increased the size of the farm whenever the opportunity arose, buying land from neighbors who had grown too old for the rigorous work, from others who wished to leave the land for the promise of the growing cities. Most of the land was cultivated, but there were still great patches of trees, thickets of brush and wild berries, small streams bridged by fat logs. In Boston, his name inspired talk of ambition, his relentless drive to build his law practice. Few understood what strength these trips home gave him, what he drew from the energizing walks over the hills and through the fields of his beloved farm. He had walked the fields all morning, climbing the hills slowly, slipping carefully through rows of corn stalks as tall as he was, through the dense thickets where the blueberry bushes grew wild. He had stepped through the mud of the creek bed, stopping long enough for a cold drink of the sweetest water he knew, enjoying a quiet moment under the great canopy of trees. He could see the houses in the distance, two dark brown cubes set side by side at an angle, the older home turned slightly, facing the side of the newer one. He had been born in the older, smaller house, the larger one now their home. The property had been in the family for 50 years, bought by his father. Deacon John Adams had always been a farmer, but had seen beyond the world to a better life for his children. He had wanted his sons to move on, discover the world of books and education. Adams smiled now, climbed up on a pile of fat rocks, stared across a wide valley to the orchard that spread beyond the houses. He thought of his father, remembered the great challenge, his father testing the young John's will. "All right, if you want to be a farmer, then by God we will farm." His father had taken him into the village, made him load the wagon with hay, gave him a hard day's lesson in the use of a pitchfork. He remembered the blisters still. It was the hardest work he had ever done, and he had never felt so much pride in his life. "My father thought he was convincing me how miserable this life was," he thought. "He didn't expect me to say I liked it." He remembered the old man's frustration, his father's words, "Well, boy, I don't like it at all. So you are going to school." He looked east, thought of Abigail's family home close to the water. So many had built there, and it had nothing to do with some connection to the sea. Most were neither fishermen nor sailors. It was as though they needed to see the watery bridge to the old country, that sense of connection, unbreakable. What no one could predict was the draw of the great wilderness. How many would begin to turn the other way, to look west? There had never been an opportunity like this for so many people, a vast, rich continent. Even the Indian conflicts had grown quiet, the people learning to accept each other, lines of trade and communication opening. The colonies are growing in the only direction they can grow, inland. And now many people look at the sea not as a bridge, but as a barrier. The old country is a memory, and the children will never even know the bond, will have no loyalty to the old ways. The English must fear that, losing the loyalty, the allegiance. His mind focused sharply, and he thought, yes, fear. That's the word. There's been too much change. Even the trade laws were never really enforced. Right there, off this coast, goods were smuggled in all the time, still are. The law says we must import only English goods, and yet ships sail into these ports from all over the world, right past the offices of the customs officials. For more than 100 years, we've been allowed to grow strong, prosperous, with few restrictions, few harsh laws. We've been allowed to elect our own assemblies, raise our own revenue. We have our own identity, so now in England there is fear. We're too strong, too prosperous, too independent. And so, suddenly, they expect to dust off the old laws and pull us back to the way the empire was in 1680. How many, English and colonists both, speak long and loud for a return to the old ways as though nothing should change? But in all of God's creation, change is the only certainty. He looked out over the green field again. It's all around us. Every season, every blade of grass, every plant, every part of the earth. Mountains crumble, land is washed away by the rivers, forests and the animals in them grow and die. He could see the piles of rock lining the edge of each field, rock cleared from the soil to allow passage of the plow blade. We change the earth ourselves, turn these rocky fields into farmland, cut the trees to make more fields. It is the arrogance of men, of those who claim to have power, kings or lawmakers, who claim to hold things constant. Keep all things as they are or as they should be, depending on the whim or policies of one man. God must find that terribly amusing. He had stayed away from most of the loud talk, but he had heard enough from his friends to know what was going on in the town meetings. It had been the tax issue that had suddenly focused his attention. "We have built this country, the farms, the businesses, changed this land from wilderness to bounty, and all the while England ignored us. Then, suddenly, some government minister wakes up and sees us as some great, bountiful milk cow just waiting to give buckets of money to their treasury. But I have never heard a Tory here ask the question, what of the consequences? What happens if a man cannot pay? What if any one of the absurd list of taxes puts a man into serious financial stress? He could lose that farm or that business. What does that do to our prosperity, to our spirit? And the suffering would spread. What would the English businessman feel if suddenly we stop importing British goods because we can't afford to pay for them? We are England's largest marketplace. He felt the joy of the day's walk slipping away, was angry at himself for allowing the politics to interfere. He looked again toward the houses, tried to see if the children were outside, but it was quiet now. He began to walk again, moved down the hill beside the rows of corn. You are not in Boston. This should be a time of relaxation. Am I unreasonable to have my own fear? You know too much of what man is capable of inflicting on himself. It is a strange aspect of being a lawyer. You see the darkest side of humanity. You become a pessimist. Captain Preston's men fire on citizens, and instead of grief or sorrow for this horrible affair, our first instinct is vengeance. An eye for an eye. Sam understands that. It's his most effective tool. But what happens when both sides seek vengeance? Reason is trampled. There can only be more violence. Pulling the troops out of Boston was good, for now. But the attitudes have not changed. England still sees us as something to be exploited. The Stamp Act didn't work. The Townshend Acts didn't work. So surely they will try to find another way to exploit us, to hold us tightly in their control. And we will keep fighting it. Every injustice will be met with protest, and the louder the protest, the angrier the response, an eye for an eye. He thought of the sermon he had heard, the preacher calling for God to intervene to set all things right. No, that is not what God does. God has given us the power to act, to change our own lives. He does not judge us on how we think, how pure we keep our thoughts. We are judged on what we do. If we believe that we are right, we must fight for that belief. If we lose the fight, we cannot be condemned for the failure. But if we do not fight, if we simply endure what we believe to be wrong, no piety, no sermons, no prayers will save us. He was close to the houses now, and he saw Abigail coming out of the larger house holding the baby in her arms. She waited for him as he crossed the last small field, thick with dense green hay. As he moved into the small open yard, he could see the tiny hands emerging from the blanket in her arms, touching her face. Was it a pleasant walk? He wanted to tell her all he had been thinking. Knew she would have something helpful to say, some clarity to add. He stared at her for a long moment, then reached out, one thick finger touching the baby's hand, the tiny fingers wrapping around his, and he said, "Yes, pleasant indeed. We'll talk about it later." She was still looking at him, and he could see it in her eyes, the quiet understanding, so much happening around them, around all of them. He moved toward the house, Abigail close beside him. And for a short while, Boston was very far away. Boston, October 1770. The witnesses had flowed through the proceedings in a steady parade, nearly four dozen in all. The prosecution had been led by Robert Treat Payne, an earnest young lawyer who did not hide his association with the radicals, those strong voices behind the protests and outcries. Like Sam Adams, Payne had become public about his involvement in the Sons of Liberty. What had begun as a secret society had become much more bold, and now no one shied away from the label, from their association with the group. But Payne carried far more than a zeal for vengeance to the courtroom. He was an eloquent and proficient speaker, and for 2 days had performed his duty before the jury with prim efficiency. His case had been simple. His stream of witnesses sought to prove, without any doubt or confusion, that it had been Captain Thomas Preston who ordered the soldiers to fire into the crowd of civilians. Adams himself had handled much of the cross-examination of the witnesses, and for the most part, attacking the prosecution's case had not been much of a challenge. Payne's witnesses had been largely contradictory, with confused memories, uncertain recollections. But there had been a few damning witnesses, men who were completely certain in their identification of Preston as the man who spoke that one fateful word, the word that could send him to the gallows, the order to fire. When Payne rested the prosecution's case, Adams had presented his own chain of witnesses. But now the testimony was much less confused. Men adamant that Preston himself had never used the word. Adams had watched the jury carefully, knew that his case rested on that most important point, uncertainty. If there was even the slightest doubt that Preston did not give the order, he must be acquitted. The testimony of the witnesses was nearly complete, and the court had adjourned for the noon meal. Adams stayed in the courtroom, studied his papers, refreshed himself on the words he had come to rely on, the wisdom, the rhetoric of so many great legal minds. He crumbled a piece of biscuit in his hand, focused on the papers, put his fingers to his mouth, but there was nothing left of the biscuit, the crumbs falling to the table. He swept the crumbs aside, still staring at the paper, and now Josiah Quincy was beside him, said quietly, "Here, try this one." Adams blinked, looked up from the paper, saw Quincy holding another biscuit, intact. He shook his head. "No, thank you, I have one. Just finished it." He looked at the paper again, the names on the witness list, did not see Quincy leaning down behind him, looking at the mountain of crumbs under his chair. "Whatever you say, John." Quincy looked over the paper in Adams' hand, said, "John, I ask you again, would you reconsider your objection?" Adams did not look up. "No." Quincy sat back, frustrated. "John, it can only help our case. If we establish that the citizens were in fact an organized mob driven by the radicals, if we can establish in the jury's mind that pushing the troops out of Boston was a concerted and organized plan, it lends strength to the potential threat of the mob, a much more potent threat to Captain Preston than just a chaotic group of citizens." Adams put the paper down, glanced over at Preston, who sat in a small partitioned area off to one side. He turned, said to Quincy, "Do you believe Thomas Preston ordered his troops to fire?" "Certainly not." "Then what else matters? If our testimony is convincing to the jury, it is not necessary to bring some political message into this proceeding." "What can it hurt, John? You know as well as I do that the sentiment in Boston against the army was a threat to the peace. You know very well that the Sons of Liberty were looking for any excuse, any spark, to set off a violent incident. It is the best weapon the town had for pressuring Governor Hutchinson to remove the troops." Adams glanced behind him now, saw Preston's friend Forrest leaning over the rail, listening carefully. Adams began to feel annoyed. "Josiah, the prosecution has not proven its case. Nearly every witness has contradicted the one before him, and hardly anyone has been able to say that he heard Preston issue the order. If we establish that the captain commanded soldiers who were victimized by an organized mob and fought back in self-defense, we have to first agree that he ordered his men to fire. We would have to justify the very thing that we are trying to disprove. But, John, it could strengthen our case. The atmosphere of this town..." "Yes, consider the atmosphere. Thus far, the jury has seemed sympathetic to our witnesses. If you introduce the notion that mob rule is so threatening, you could suddenly plant the idea in their minds that any jury who acquits Captain Preston could be subject to the same threats. I cannot accept that we should pretend there is no rule of law here. Captain Preston is not guilty. That is our only focus." He was angry now. Pointed to the paper on the table. "See here, our next witness is Richard Palms. If I cannot make our case with his testimony, if you are convinced that by introducing the truthful testimony of eyewitnesses we have not established the innocence of our client—" He turned, looked at Forrest. "If you, sir, do not feel that I have performed with suitable competence in making the case for your friend, then I will step aside. Mr. Quincy, if the arguments of law are not acceptable to you, if mere truth is not satisfactory, you may try this case yourself." Adams saw Forrest look at Quincy, wide-eyed, and Quincy put a hand on Adams' arm. "Please, John, I will defer to your strategy." "It is not strategy, Josiah." He saw faces watching him, realized his voice had carried. There was a stillness in the large room, and he saw Payne looking at him, the man's irritating smugness reflected in a slight smile. Adams glanced over toward Preston, saw the man staring at him with pale-faced panic. Adams stood, walked over to the prisoner's box. "Captain, do not be concerned." Preston tried to whisper, his voice cracking slightly. "Concern? Is there some problem of which I am not aware? Please, Mr. Adams." Adams put a hand out, touched Preston's shoulder. "Captain, it's all right, I assure you. The testimony is in our favor." "Mr. Adams, that one man, Mr. Califf, he said he was positive it was me. He identified me, said he saw me give the order. He was lying." Adams gripped Preston's arm tightly, said in a quiet hiss, "Calm, Captain. Calm. You must have confidence in your own innocence. You must have confidence in the testimony of our witnesses. One man's testimony will not convict you, not if I can help it." "But he was so bloody certain." "Captain, a great many more are not certain at all. You must allow me to do my job. Do not show the jury you are afraid. The truth is on your side." Preston sat back in the chair, nodded slowly. "God help us, Mr. Adams." Adams backed away. "We don't need God, Captain. We need one more witness." "Mr. Palms, what is your position in this community, sir?"
"I am a merchant, sir."
"Would you describe yourself as a Tory?" There was a murmur in the courtroom, and Adams saw the defiant look on Palm's face, waited for the man's answer.
"Sir, I would as soon be labeled a skirt-wearing nursemaid."
There was laughter now, and Adams waited patiently, heard one of the judges now, a sharp shout, "Enough of that, there will be order." The room grew quiet, and Adams continued. "Mr. Palms, do you consider yourself a loyal subject of King George III?
"Most definitely, sir."
"Then how can you claim such distaste for being a Tory?"
"Sir, Tories are blind followers of whatever England would have us do."
Palms seemed nervous now, glanced at the judges. "It's all right, Mr. Palms, no one is accusing you of any disloyalty. I am trying to point out to this court that you have no prejudice, no reason whatever to make statements here that would tend to free Captain Preston of the charges against him. You are not an agent for His Majesty. You have no agenda in seeing Captain Preston go free." There was silence now, and Adams stood back. "Now it will come," he thought, "if he has the courage to say it, to use the words, it will silence any objection." Palms seemed to grow angry, defiant again, and Adams thought, "Yes, good. Come on, say it." Palms leaned forward.
"Mr. Adams, I do not care a bit whether Captain Preston goes free or not. I have friends in this town, in this room, in fact, sir, who know my political leanings. I am no errand boy for anyone in England. I consider myself, sir—"
He glanced at the judges again, then out to the gallery of onlookers who were hanging on his words. He seemed to draw strength from the faces of his friends.
"I consider myself, sir, a son of liberty."
There was a sudden whoop from the crowd, applause, and the judges again quieted the crowd. Adams felt a warm glow in his chest. "Thank you, yes, indeed. Thank you, sir."
So, Mr. Palms, if Captain Preston is found guilty by this court, you have some friends who would rejoice at that, certainly. I expect they would, yes, sir.
Adams felt a rush of strength, raised his voice, said slowly, each word echoing through the large room,
"Then tell us, Mr. Palms, what happened? What did you see on the night of March 5th?
Palms took a deep breath, glanced at Preston, then spoke.
"I came into King Street, moved through the crowd of people in front of the custom house. I saw Mr. Theodore Bliss speaking to Captain Preston. Mr. Bliss asked Captain Preston, 'Why don't you fire?' And he said it again, with more oath. He said, 'God damn you, why don't you fire?'"
Adams nodded slowly.
"Please continue, sir." "I was close to Captain Preston. I wanted to speak to the crowd, to say something, to calm the people. I looked at Captain Preston and saw his face staring at them. He seemed afraid. I went to stand directly in front of him, thought maybe I could protect him from the sticks and such."
"Why? Why would you protect a soldier?"
"I said he was afraid. They were all afraid. The crowd was loud, shouting, throwing all manner of things."
"Go on, sir."
"Captain Preston looked straight at me, and I put my hand on his shoulder, and then someone shouted, 'Fire!'"
There were sounds again from the spectators, and Adams did not hesitate. "How close were you to him, Mr. Palms?"
"I already said, sir, I had my hand on his shoulder."
"Do you have evidence of that, sir?"
Palms raised his arm. "I was wearing this coat, sir. If you see here, there is a burn mark. Black powder. It came from the musket of one of the soldiers. Captain Preston and I were standing right in front of them."
Adams stepped to one side, waited as Palms held the scorched coat sleeve up for the court to see. "Mr. Palms, were you looking at Captain Preston, at his face?"
"Yes, sir."
"Directly at his face?"
"Sir, there was so much commotion, so much noise, you couldn't hear a man's voice. I was looking, in fact, sir, at his mouth, in case he said something."
"Are you absolutely certain that Captain Preston did not say the word fire?"
"God may strike me dead, sir. He never said the word fire."
The crowd erupted, some cheering, some shouting angrily. The judges were trying to control the spectators, and Adams looked at the jury now, saw all 12 faces staring hard at Palms, absorbing the moment, the man's words. He glanced at Payne, saw gloom, the man shuffling papers, avoiding the faces of the jury. As Payne lifted his head, Adams caught his eye, made a slight nod. "All right, sir, cross-examine him, if you please. But you know it as well as I do. As well as everyone here, this trial is already over." The jury reached a verdict in 3 hours, and Captain Preston walked from the courtroom a free man. Adams knew that Preston would not stay long in the town. There would still be a threat from the mob, someone whose anger would erase what any court might decide. Quietly, without any fanfare or even notice from the town, Preston's personal effects were loaded on board a ship, and he made ready to cross the Atlantic.
"Come in, Captain. I thought you might have sailed already."
Preston slipped inside the office door, appeared self-conscious, and Adams said, "Relax, Captain. No mobs here today." It was a feeble joke, but Preston seemed not to have heard, looked at him anxiously, unsmiling.
"I thought I should at least say goodbye, Mr. Adams. I only have a few minutes."
Adams pointed toward the chair. "Have a seat, Captain. Enjoy your last few moments on hard ground. When do you expect to reach England?" It was an attempt at pleasant conversation, and Adams could see that Preston would not participate, was glancing absently around the office.
"What's on your mind, Captain?"
Preston stared away, would not look at him.
"I felt it was my duty to come here. I am anxious to leave this place. I don't imagine I will ever return to these shores."
"No, I don't imagine you will."
Preston looked at him now, and Adams saw dark anger, a glint in the man's eye.
"It's bloody dangerous for me to even be seen on the streets here. I'm losing my command. The 29th is already gone. None of the men I served with would speak to me before they left."
"Why not?"
because I can't even defend my own men. Your precious court, oh bloody hell.
Yes, young man, Adams thought, this is the price. They wanted to try you with your men. One trial for all of you. Do you know what would have happened?
We've been through all that, Mr. Adams. If I didn't order them to fire, then they fired on their own account. If I'm innocent, they're guilty. If they're innocent, it had to be because the responsibility was mine. Legal gibberish, Mr. Adams. My men are no more guilty of killing that rabble than I am.
I'll do what I can.
Is that right? You're planning on defending them too, are you?
I thought you knew.
Of course, Mr. Quincy and I will handle their case.
Preston's anger seemed to slip away.
How do you think it'll go for them?
Adams looked down at his hands. We'll do our best, Captain. The law still relies on truth, on proof of guilt. They cannot be convicted of murder if the court cannot prove to a jury that there was murder committed.
Preston shook his head. Murder? There was no murder, Mr. Adams. It was self-defense.
We'll certainly explore that, yes.
Preston sat quietly for a moment. I didn't come here hating anyone, Mr. Adams. Didn't understand how much they'd hate us. Did we deserve that?
Adams considered the question. It wasn't the soldiers, the men, faces and names. You were just a tool, a piece on a chessboard. And you may never understand that.
Captain, when soldiers are sent to maintain order, it's because someone has decided that order has broken down. In Boston, there is a struggle for power. You were sent here to end that struggle, but the struggle is not over guns and strength and who has the most men. Governor Hutchinson represents the authority of England, and some would say the Sons of Liberty represent the voice of the people. It's about freedom and self-government, all the things this colony was guaranteed by its own charter.
Preston was staring at him with no expression. He doesn't understand, Adams concluded. And it's not his fault. It's not his job to understand.
Preston sat for a moment longer, then seemed to snap awake. What time? Excuse me, Mr. Adams, but I'd best be going. The ship's sailing pretty quick. I hope you'll do what you say. Take good care of my men.
Preston was on his feet now, and Adams leaned across the desk, held out a hand. Preston hesitated, looked at it for a brief moment, took the hand, a quick shake, said nothing, then quickly left. Adams watched the door close.
A thank you would have been nice.
He sat down, leaned back in the soft leather of the chair.
No, not the time for thank yous. It's the true sign of an innocent man. Leave it to the guilty to gush and grovel their gratitude, bursting with relief that the good lawyer saved them from their punishment. All we did was ensure the truth was heard and that one man received justice.
I shouldn't expect gratitude for that.
I should be condemned if I fail.
December 1770. The trial of the 8 soldiers lasted into December. With Preston already on his way to England, the only testimony would come from many of the same witnesses with many of the same flaws and confusion. Of the 8 soldiers charged, 6 were acquitted, the eyewitness accounts failing to prove that any one of them had actually killed a citizen. 2 others were convicted of manslaughter, and when the verdicts were read, the 2 men immediately pleaded the benefit of clergy, an arcane custom that removed them from the jurisdiction of civil punishment. The men instead would receive a branding on one hand, a symbol of guilt they would carry the rest of their lives. As the trials ended, the voices of the mob had turned quickly toward Adams and Josiah Quincy, but it was not dangerous. The remarks were subdued, more of politics than violence, questioning loyalty rather than making threats against the home. Adams had heard the sharp words in the street, had come to expect it any time he left his office.
But it was the newspapers, the anonymous articles that attacked the acquittals, that sought to keep the public passion high with strange and inaccurate accounts of the trials. Adams read the articles with wonder, for their intent was obvious and clumsy. But as the articles continued, he could not help notice that his name was rarely mentioned, and finally he was ignored altogether. It was not personal, after all. Adams was still in Boston, would miss the first snow in Braintree, had begun to wait each day for the delivery of the packages and letters from the roads to the south. Abigail wrote to him nearly every day, newsy letters, the business of the farm, the children, always a self-conscious note about the growth of the baby. He stood in the doorway of the small townhouse, held her letter, read it over again. She had never been very good at spelling, the disadvantage of a limited education, something of a sore point with her now. It was simply the custom that the girls might receive some formal tutoring in numbers, perhaps basic mathematics, but rarely letters, rarely the skills in reading or science. She had taken that upon herself, particularly reading, the ancient classics, novels, and histories. Her enthusiasm for learning was passionate, and she sought out other women who felt as she did, would correspond in long and thoughtful letters with new friends who believed with her that a woman could indeed find a place in a man's world. He would never argue with her, enjoyed her new discoveries, worked hard at finding unfamiliar books, opening new roads for her. Her letters were frequently filled with a wondrous exploration of some new philosophy, some historical event explored for the first time. He glanced again at the letter in his hand, saw the first words, "Dearest friend." She referred to herself as Portia, Shakespeare's cultured and educated woman from The Merchant of Venice. He smiled now, as it was an old joke between them. "My paper is very cheap. C-H-E-E-P. Shall you light, L-I-T-E, your pipe with them?" He shook his head at the amazing spelling. "No, I shall never discard this." He thought of the reply already forming in his mind. "No, I shall hold this paper as dear as the heart of my Portia." The words drifted away, would come back later that night, and he stood watching the fat snowflakes, the street now a blanket of solid white, deep enough so that even the horses would have a struggle. He thought of the ride home, knew the snow would stretch it out, a test of his patience. "And I will return to Boston, probably too soon to suit my family. There can be none of the luxury of vacation, not yet. I am a long way from behaving like the old established lawyers with their great staffs of workers, the hum of the office like so many bees. But if there are many more autumns like this one, that wonderful opportunity to do something in the courtroom that truly matters." He was feeling very good, truly proud of the work he had done for Preston, the other soldiers. He knew his own reputation was growing in Boston, despite the controversy. He wondered about London if anyone there had heard the details of the trial. Are they even aware of what we did, of just what those trials demonstrated? Do the British have any comprehension of how we conduct ourselves, that we are fully capable of exercising a system of law and justice every bit as civilized as their own? He recalled the words he had used in the trial of the 8 soldiers, his closing argument. He had practiced and perfected his speech, would probably never use the phrases again, but they stayed hard inside of him, drifting through his memory. "Facts are stubborn things. The law, no passion can disturb. It is void of desire and fear, lust and anger. It is deaf, inexorable, inflexible." Chapter 6. Franklin. London, January 1771. Franklin had been enjoying his morning tea, but Mrs. Stevenson had brought him a letter, and now the pleasant ritual was spoiled.
The news had come from an unexpected place, from the hand of a young mother, a sadness presented with the matter-of-factness of someone who doesn't truly understand the grief felt by someone else, even her own child. It had begun with an unusually strange gesture from Deborah, a gift uniquely American. Nestled into the hold of a great ship, packed tightly between bags and boxes, barrels and crates, a small cage that held one gray squirrel had survived the rough seas and haphazard care to be delivered to the pleasure of a little girl whose family was close friends with Mrs. Stevenson. The girl had named the squirrel Skug, but despite Skug's resiliency for travel, it could not compete with the ambitions of another pet, a dog, whose instincts were the hunt. The result was predictable. It was a deadly competition. The squirrel could not survive. Franklin could imagine the little girl in his mind, had seen the smiles, the joy in the young beauty. He had never quite understood why a squirrel would bring such squeals of delight, had thought the gift an odd one. But he had long ago stopped questioning Deborah's wisdom about what pleases the female. He glanced at the letter. The sorrow from the girl's mother, more an expression of guilt, the regret that she had not taken more precautions to keep the dog away from the squirrel. He shook his head. So much attention to such an annoying little animal. But there is no explaining the affections of a young girl, especially when fur and whiskers are parts of the equation. Now they seek some comfort, some words of forgiveness, as though somehow, by the squirrel's death, they have wronged me. He thought a moment, reached for a pen, slid a piece of paper close. He raised the pen, searched for an epitaph, some lasting tribute, some words to grace a tiny tombstone. The small fellow shall leave a legacy, I suppose. He wrote, "Here Skug lies snug as a bug in a rug." He frowned. Thought of the little girl. No, that's a bit too coarse. I should pay a proper tribute. The creature was, after all, much more well-traveled than most of its kind. His attention was broken by the sound of a carriage. He shifted to his perch at the window, knew his friend Strawn would take his time, a leisurely stroll to the entrance of the house. It was done with slow purpose, and Franklin shivered slightly in the sharp cold air, peered out, tried to see Strawn's face. He waited for the self-conscious glance upward to the window, and Strawn obliged him, a quick, furtive look, the quiet laugh. His friend was out of sight now, below him at the front door, and Franklin listened for the knock. "He is taking his time, as he always does." "Well, go ahead, Strawn. She knows you're coming." He heard the squeal of the hinges, the faint voice of Mrs. Stevenson. He waited for the door to close, the squeal again, the creaky hinge he would not repair, too useful, a signal to alert him when someone visited the house. He scrambled to work now, his clothes laid out in perfect sequence, pulled and tightened and tied, heard the footsteps on the stairs, Mrs. Stevenson's voice again, anxious, the ritual played out perfectly. He imagined their faces, her nervousness, concern that Mr. Strawn might arrive too soon, catch the eminent doctor in the embarrassment of his state of undress. He knew Strawn was well aware, and he could hear the small talk between them, a flow of words that meant nothing, passing the time, the last bit of delay, before Franklin could put them suddenly at ease by appearing fully dressed. He tugged at the laces on his shoes, heard the silence outside the door, knew they had arrived, their self-consciousness complete. He moved quickly to the door, listening, heard one short mumble, one throat clearing, and now he stepped back, pulling the door open. "Ah, Will, a pleasant surprise. Do come in." He watched both their faces, saw the visible relief, the quick scan of his clothing, the long exhale of breath. He was fully satisfied now, the ritual complete, saw Mrs. Stevenson moving away down the stairs, shaking her head, her mortification put away once more. Strawn whisked past him into the room, went to the window. "Really, Ben, do you mind if I close this? There's a bit of a nip in the breeze, even for you."
"If you must, Will. I do admit these old bones are not standing up to the cold the way they used to."
Strawn pulled the window shut, shook his head slightly. "Then you should exercise some care. If you won't listen to me, then be influenced by common sense. You just passed 65 years, my friend, and I'm right there with you. Old bones, indeed. And even this rickety old typesetter has wisdom enough not to expose himself to the danger of the cold. You're as rickety as you choose to be, Will." They had been through this before. He knew that Strawn didn't agree with his theories about the benefit of fresh air, hot or cold. Strawn said, "I suppose I choose to be as rickety as befits a man of my years. You, however, I imagine you will be swimming in the English Channel when the rest of us are too old to float." Franklin rubbed the roundness of his stomach. "I'll be floating a while yet, and to swim in the Channel is a fine idea, but there's too much ice today. I'll wait for the thaw." Strawn was smiling now, sat down slowly. He reached in his pocket, pulled out a small packet of letters, held them out. "For you, I stopped by the wharf on the way over. There's a frigate just in. I assumed there might be mail for you." Franklin looked at the letters, one with the flowery handwriting of his daughter, the other with the official seal of the governor of New Jersey. "My children are quite efficient at fulfilling their father's expectations." He put Sally's letter on the small table, ran his finger over the wax seal on the letter from his son. "At least when it comes to letter writing." Strawn sat back, held up his hand. "It's long forgotten, Ben, not even a hint of heartbreak. My son is doing quite well, you know. Made him a full partner. Hasn't married yet. I keep him too busy. I understand Sally has found a husband that she finds more suitable." "Suitable to her." It was a familiar joke, but Franklin still fingered the letter from his son, thinking it bothers Will more than he admits. "I couldn't make it happen, couldn't force Sally to marry the boy. Deborah didn't want it to happen at all, knew that Sally might have moved to England. And Deborah had more influence on Sally than either of them would admit. If I had been there, perhaps it would have been different." Strawn was watching him, and Franklin tried to think past it, bring back the humor. He put William's letter on top of his daughter's. "I'll read them both later. I already know what Sally's letter will say. There will be all sorts of flattery about her husband, how wonderful he is, how much I will come to love him, how we will be lifelong friends." "Forget it, Ben. We've moved past all that." "Oh, yes, I know. Of course we have. I wasn't thinking about that." Strawn said nothing. "I thought it was a father's prerogative to have some influence about these things," Franklin went on to fill the silence. "I don't, you know. They've made it pretty clear. Give Sally a chance, Ben. She has enough of you in her. Trust her instincts. I'm sure her husband is a great deal more nervous about meeting you." "I'm hardly nervous. I had just hoped she would allow... No, that's not right. I had hoped Deborah would allow me to play a greater role." He looked at the table again. "What do you suppose my son has to say?" "Official business from the royal governor of New Jersey, I suppose." Franklin picked up the letter. "I should be pleased. He asks my advice. Nearly every time he writes me, he asks if I know the proper course for him to follow. He asks me to finish his letters for him. He has to send all sorts of reports to Lord Hillsborough, but he wants me to edit them." "Does Lord Hillsborough know that?" "Certainly not. Wouldn't help William's reputation at the ministry." Strawn laughed, said, "Your son respects you, Ben. He's a royal governor. He's an agent for the king. My advice would be considered highly suspect in those circles." "Let's just say you have their attention," Strawn responded, more serious now. Franklin knew that his friend was close to many in the king's circle of intimates, especially Samuel Johnson. "Seems you have their attention too, Will, even more than usual. I've heard rumors that your name is the only one on the list to become the king's official printer." Strawn seemed surprised. "Didn't know it was common knowledge. I have a few friends in important places. They've been recommending me to the king for some time now. Seems he's heard them." "It was only a matter of time. Someone in the palace probably made note of how many books you've been providing me. You said I had their attention. This way the king can keep track of what you're printing." It was a joke. but Strawn's expression didn't lighten. Franklin felt the sudden strain, their relationship infected with this sudden formality whenever politics came up. He knew better than to bring up the subject of the difficulties in the colonies. He kept his work as private as polite conversation would allow, but Strawn had been his friend for 30 years, the two men corresponding through letters and business dealings long before they ever actually met. All the talk of wedding their children had been humorous at first, Sally barely 8 years old when it began, but as the children grew, so did the wishful thinking of their fathers, and though there had never truly been a courtship, both men had seemed to take the talk more seriously than anyone else in their families. It was a strong symbol of the depth of their friendship. But now, watching Strawn turn suddenly uncomfortable, a slight frown, Franklin knew something was changing between them. But he would not give in to the mood, and tried a wide smile. "I've had the attention of those fellows for some time. Talk gets back to me. They're concerned that their deputy postmaster for the colonies is in league with dangerous elements."
"Aren't you?"
Strawn let a smile cross his face, and Franklin was relieved, the humor returning. They had played this game before, and Franklin said, "I will tell you first, Will, you know that. They send me all those pamphlets, but I don't read them. And Lord knows you can't trust the newspapers. I'm just a simple servant doing my job." Strawn reached into his pocket.
"Oh, that reminds me. Forgive me, simple servant. There's one more letter."
Franklin saw another seal, different. No sign of the crown in the wax. He glanced at Strawn. "Forgive you indeed. You saving this one, what for effect? Dramatic impact? I suppose you expect me to open it. Curiosity getting the better of you?" Strawn could not hide the seriousness in his voice. "Came from a different ship. A packet. Just in from Boston. You probably should open that one." Franklin turned the letter over in his hand, felt a small stab of nervousness. Strawn's attention was now hard and focused. "Well, all right then. How much harm can this do?" He slid his finger under the seal, broke the wax, unfolded the letter slowly. The nervousness was gone, replaced by surprise. He looked at Strawn, who was leaning forward, nearly off the chair.
"Anything interesting?"
"You might say that. It seems the People's Assembly of the Colony of Massachusetts has decided that I should represent them. They have appointed me as their agent." The roads were muddy, and he felt sympathy for the man driving the horses, knew he would be filthy, miserable, the hooves kicking up an awful mess the driver could not ignore. The carriage slipped from side to side, lurched in a sudden jerk, one wheel finding a deep pothole. He tried to keep his focus away from the terrible road, stared at the crystal blue of the January sky, unusual, the thick gray clouds swept away, a blessed break in the dismal London winter. The carriage jerked again, bounced him hard on the leather seat, and he heard the voice of the driver, a quick apology. They had left the hardened streets of the city behind, rolled into farm country, larger estates, the homes of English high society. They passed through a patch of dense woods, skeletons of trees, a small brook running under the narrow roadway. The carriage climbed out of the thicket, and the land flattened out, rows of neatly trimmed trees, a garden, the country opening up into a beautifully groomed estate. The driver turned the carriage into a narrow driveway lined tightly with thick bushes. There was very little beauty here, mostly dense clusters of brown, and Franklin saw a wide stretch of open ground beyond, bleak gardens, bare earth swept clean of last year's stems. There was no sign that there had ever been death and decay here, only fresh black dirt waiting patiently for the warmth of the spring to return. The carriage ride was smoother now, the drive tended to by men with rakes and shovels. He adjusted himself on the seat, tried to undo the kinks put into his back by the ride. The carriage pulled up in front of the grand mansion, and he studied the architecture. Impressive. The tall columns, long, narrow windows, black against the clean white marble. The driver was down now, opened the door, and Franklin stepped out, avoided the mud dripping off the side of the carriage. There was a quick flurry of activity from one end of the house, and a man appeared, adjusting his coat, hurrying forward.
"Good day, sir. Allow me."
The man reached for the bridle of the horse.
"Would you be staying long, eh, sir? I can stable the horse for you."
Franklin was still looking at the grandeur of the house. "Not exactly sure. Give me just a moment." He moved to the front entrance, wide twin doors framed by ornately carved wood. The door suddenly opened, and he saw a tall, thin man staring past him with cold black eyes, bored annoyance.
"Yes, what is it?"
The voice faded slowly, and Franklin studied the man's face, deathly pale, etched with a permanent frown. "The butler, I suppose, and very inconvenienced by my presence." "Hello, this is an official call. Dr. Benjamin Franklin to see Lord Hillsborough." The man sniffed, the door already closing, the man's voice trailing away as he said, "Lord Hillsborough is not at home." The door shut with a heavy thunk, and Franklin stared into the dark wood. How wonderfully polite! He waited for a moment, expecting the door to open again, began to feel self-conscious. "The longer I stay here, the sillier I will appear." He looked around, saw his driver and the groomsmen watching him, hiding their smiles. How obnoxious of me to assume that anyone in this fine old home would appreciate a visit from a colonist. He stepped carefully across the soft ground, moved to the carriage, the driver quickly in front of him pulling the door open. The groomsman was close now, said cheerfully,
"Well now, off you go. Drive him slow. The road's bloody awful. Could lose a leg."
Franklin climbed into the carriage. "Thank you, I'll be fine." He saw a strange expression on the man's face, suddenly realized the man's concern was for the horse. Well, of course. In this neighborhood, even a mare has more stature than an American. The driver climbed up on the carriage, waited, and Franklin said, "Let's go, shall we?" The whip cracked, and the carriage lurched forward, and suddenly there was a shout, the groomsmen running alongside. The carriage stopped, and Franklin looked back to the house, saw the butler standing in the door of the house, displaying an expression of painful impatience. The groomsmen opened the carriage door, and Franklin leaned out, heard the butler announce, "His lordship will see you now." Franklin looked at the groomsmen. "Apparently I don't understand the rules. Seems we weren't supposed to actually leave." The man made a bow, smiled. He had seen it all before. Franklin moved slowly into the large room with dark walls and high shelves. He was surprised to see several men all dressed in the formal fluff and finery of political office. The activity ceased as the men became aware of his presence, slowly moving to greet him. He scanned the room quickly, always afraid of committing the faux pas of failing to acknowledge first the man with the highest title. He did not see Hillsborough, and one man was quickly in front of him, extending a hand.
"Why, Dr. Franklin, an unexpected pleasure."
The man waited for Franklin to respond, and he searched the man's face, familiar, fought for the name. "Ah, yes, Governor Bernard." There was a silence. Bernard's smile faded, and he seemed to hesitate.
"It's no longer governor, sir. I'm sure you know that I have returned to England permanently. The king has graciously granted me a baronetcy. I won't be returning to Massachusetts."
The entire account flowed into Franklin's mind now. Bernard's amazing ability to alienate the people he was sent to govern, his replacement by Thomas Hutchinson. Bernard's recall was as much a rescue from the wrath of the Sons of Liberty as it was anything to do with the granting of some obscure title. Franklin forced a smile. Faux pas, indeed.
"Certainly, yes, I was aware. May I extend my congratulations on your good fortune, and, welcome you home?"
Bernard seemed to slide away slowly, and Franklin was met by other hands, smiles and cordiality, could glimpse Bernard pouring something from a crystal decanter. He saw glasses scattered around the room, some half full. Well, it's not all business. I should feel honored to be included. He saw the butler again, the servant carrying a flat velvet pillow that cradled a small, three-cornered hat, gold trim on dark blue silk. The voices in the room grew quiet, and Franklin looked toward the open door, saw Hillsborough now, a short, compact man, a tight, round face clamped into a perpetual scowl. The butler stood to one side, and Hillsborough reached for the hat, set it gently on his powdered wig, adjusted it slightly, examined himself carefully in a small hand mirror.
"Very well, that will do. Have the carriage brought around."
The butler was quickly gone, and Franklin waited in the silence, glanced at the men around him. The decanter was being passed, and Franklin heard whispers, louder now, low conversation. "They're not afraid of him," Franklin realized. "It's all just politeness." Hillsborough still groomed himself in the mirror, and Franklin stepped forward gingerly. "He may have no idea I'm here." Franklin remembered the smile on his own face, strengthened it, and now Hillsborough set the mirror aside, satisfied, and looked directly at Franklin.
"I'm on my way to court, Mr. Franklin. However, I understand you are a man who gets down to business, as they say, so when they told me you were at the door, I decided to see you immediately."
Franklin bent slightly. "I thank your lordship. My business is brief. With all respect, sir, I wish to present your lordship my appointment, however unworthy I may be, by the Assembly of Massachusetts to be their agent here. I am pleased to be of service."
"Mr. Franklin, I must correct you. You are not agent."
The sound in the large room had died away, and Franklin was confused. "I don't understand, my lord."
"You are not appointed."
"Forgive me, my lord, I have the appointment in my pocket." Hillsborough glanced around the room, the tight frown fixed hard on his face.
"You are mistaken. I have a late letter from Governor Hutchinson. He would not give his assent to the bill."
Franklin began to feel a cold pinch in his stomach. "My lord, there was no bill. It was a vote of the Assembly." Hillsborough took a deep breath, his irritation now growing, a slight rise in his voice.
"There was a bill presented to the governor for the purpose of appointing you, to which the governor refused his assent."
Franklin felt the slow burn of anger. Something is wrong. This is a simple formality. Hutchinson has nothing to do with it. "I cannot understand this, my lord. I think there must be some mistake." Hillsborough motioned to one man, said,
"Mr. Pownall, Mr. Franklin has the nerve to be skeptical of what I tell him. Do you have Governor Hutchinson's letter in which he refuses his assent for appointing Mr. Franklin as agent?"
All faces turned to this man, who now stood, glanced at Franklin, said,
No, my lord. The letter relates to a bill calling for payment of salary to the previous agent. Governor Hutchinson has determined the amount to be excessive, and thus he refused his assent. It's right here, my lord."
Franklin could see redness on Hillsborough's face now, noticed his voice rising a note higher.
"Mr. Pownall, is there nothing in that letter regarding Mr. Franklin's appointment?"
"No, my lord."
Franklin was staring at Hillsborough. "Yes, remember every detail of this. Something is going on here for which I will likely pay some price." He reached into his pocket, pulled out the appointment letter. "My lord, my appointment was delivered by the most recent ship from Boston. Here is the authentic copy of the vote of the House appointing me, in which there is no mention of any act or any submission to Governor Hutchinson. Will your lordship care to examine it?" Hillsborough took the letter, held it tightly in his hand, did not read it.
"What would you have me do with this, Mr. Franklin?"
"Sir, I am presenting this to your lordship so that you may enter my name with the Board of Trade. I have done this before upon my other appointments." Hillsborough seemed to glow dark red, and he held the letter out toward Franklin, said in an angry growl,
"It will not be entered in any such place, not while I have anything to do with such matters. We shall take no notice of any agents who are not appointed or approved by the royal governors."
So that's it, Franklin thought. It's all about who chooses the agent.
My lord, I cannot conceive why the approval of the governor should be thought necessary for the appointment of an agent for the people. It seems to me that
I will not enter into a dispute with you, sir, on this subject.
Franklin absorbed Hillsborough's anger. Back up. You're on dangerous ground here. I beg your lordship's pardon. I do not presume to dispute the issue. I would only say... The words were boiling up now. Too many words, too much frustration. He paused for a moment, felt the anticipation in the room around him. I would only say that it seems to me that every body of men who cannot appear in person, and whose business is decided, whose fate is determined by others, should have the right of being represented by an agent. This is established policy for all the colonies. The concurrence of the governor is not only unnecessary, it is interference. The governor is an agent of the king. It is up to the people's assembly alone to choose who should represent their interests. He stopped, saw Hillsborough shaking his head, the hot anger replaced by a patronizing smirk, waiting for Franklin to complete his speech. Franklin felt his own anger slipping into a muddle of confused thoughts, the words flowing together. Hillsborough said,
"I do not recognize this appointment. This is an offense to the principles set forward through my office. Mr. Franklin, when I came into this position, I found the administration of American affairs to be in great disorder. By my firmness, much of that is mended. And while I have the honor to hold the seals of this office, I shall continue with the same firmness. It is my duty to the king and to the government of this nation. If they do not approve my conduct, then they may remove me from this office as they please. But I have heard no criticism."
His voice began to rise again, the anger returning.
"What I hear instead, Mr. Franklin, is that my firmness, my discipline, is a refreshing change of course. The administration of the colonies, the abuses that we have allowed to be inflicted on the king's subjects, I will not suffer the king's empire to be humiliated and abused by the rabble of Massachusetts."
Hillsborough seemed to run out of words, was breathing hard, staring at him with raw heat. Franklin held the man's stare. "Enough. This serves no purpose. I beg your lordship's pardon for taking up so much of your time. It is, I believe, of no great importance whether the appointment is acknowledged or not. I believe it is clear to everyone that no agent of the people can expect to be of any service to the colonies any longer. I shall therefore give your lordship no further trouble." Franklin did not feel the jolts as the horse pounded along the muddy road. His mind was far beyond the bouncing carriage. He felt a strange calm. Replayed his own words, the fiery anger of Lord Hillsborough. He is in charge of administering the affairs of America, of addressing the problems, solving the controversies, supporting and managing the policies of the king in a land where the king is moving farther and farther away. Why would he become so angry at me? It has to be, of course, because I am here. I come to him suddenly representing Massachusetts. I'm a symbol. Surely that wasn't lost on Governor Bernard. He's a symbol as well. Failure. He lost control, the governor who could not govern. Now I stand before Lord Hillsborough and announce that if he wants to address the people of Massachusetts, he will do it through me. He can withhold his acknowledgement of that if he wants to, but it's not his decision, it's the decision of the people. He looked out the window of the carriage, saw a dull red sunset, felt the rocking now, the sudden jounce from the bad road. So what will happen? I spoke a bit too plainly, that's for certain. I wonder how long it will take Strawn to hear about that. He'll come to me with that cautiousness, warn me about speaking out of turn. Words travel quickly here, and it is different now, something new. Words just might become dangerous. He thought of the Stamp Act, an issue he had supported at first, had even used his influence to have a close friend appointed Stamp Commissioner for Philadelphia. I was too far removed from the mood of the people. I had no idea how the act would be received there. I didn't really understand it myself. They nearly lynched my friend, drove him from his home. Some of those people still don't believe that I changed my position, that I worked so hard to have the act repealed. I made a mistake, and mistakes aren't easily forgiven.
Some people in Philadelphia still assume they see me as too much of an Englishman. He sat back, looked out toward the last glow in the sky, laughed. So now the good folks here will see me as too much of an American. I was caught off guard by the hostility of the colonies to the Stamp Act, found myself holding a precarious perch right in the middle of a lot of angry voices. Now it's happening again. But this time I'm not off guard. He thought of Strawn. Well, old friend, you're in the middle as well. I'm on one side, and the whole corrupt blindness of your government is on the other. He looked away from the sunset, stared into the darkness of the carriage, was suddenly uneasy, his stomach turning. He thought of the letter from his son, the careless remarks he had made to Strawn, criticizing his son's habits of asking so many questions, seeking advice. To me, it's just somewhat ridiculous and a little embarrassing. William is the royal governor of New Jersey. He should know what on earth he's supposed to think about everything that comes through his office. He should be asking my advice about raising his own son, his exercise habits, what to plant in his garden. But to them, to Hillsborough, William's letters could be interpreted as opening up the sensitive business of his office to an agent of those rowdy people in Massachusetts. And I made sure my friend, Strawn, knows all about it. Foolish. Dangerous. Remember, old man, the Italian proverb, he who is a sheep is eaten by the wolves. You are now a symbol. It is one thing to represent those quiet folks in Georgia or those Quakers in Pennsylvania, but now they know you will be in close touch with those other fellows, the ones who get their names in the newspapers. Certainly Hillsborough is paying close attention to how Governor Hutchinson handles his job. If Hutchinson makes mistakes, if he's as clumsy as Bernard, the Sons of Liberty will make him a target. And Hillsborough just might respond by making a target out of me.
This ends Disc 3.